home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson, executive produced by Garrett Miller. Tonight we have a fascinating show. I can't wait. It isn't particularly LGBT oriented, as we probably won't get into very many of the LGBT situations, but we are living in what will be an unprecedented historical time when people look back on this time period, where the behavior of sexual predators was literally opened up across the board, scandals all over the place, and hopefully an incredible change in behavior in society. The thing that a lot of observers are noticing, however, is that the behavior of organizations and environment where these are coming out is demonstrably different from the film, TV, media world, and the political government world, where in the TV world, things are happening very quickly. Matt Lauer is gone. As soon as it hits, they're out. They're done. It's finished, you know, and off we go. Whereas on the government side, nobody moves. They're still all in place, running for office and in office and all of that sort of stuff. So tonight we are going to take a hard look at that, and we've brought in some experts. We have our regular panel, which tonight consists of the expert journalist, Brody Levesque. But we also are going to be welcoming constitutional law professor Kimberly Whaley, and she has given a lot of thought, information, research. She is a former assistant U.S. attorney and associate independent counsel in the Whitewater investigation, and so she has a lot of expertise she's going to bring to the table on this situation. Right up front, I want to welcome Brody to the show. Welcome, Brody.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good. So before we bring our special guest, I wanted to see what other insight you had on this this scandalous situation that we find ourselves in.
Well, I think what we're beginning to see is a domino effect, if you will, and a greater heightened awareness by the public as to the depth and extent of the problem. I think that Professor Whaley will be able to kind of set the constitutional and legal parameters for it. But from a cultural point of view, we're beginning to see that we're finally getting people to understand that this is a problem that just hasn't gone away. It continues to be a problem, and it needs addressing. And we really do need a level playing field for women and for others that are victimized by these predators. And we've got to make, you know, folks understand that this is just simply something that we can't have. Now, in my profession in the media industry, we've been pretty good about, you know, doing effective, I think, not knee-jerk, but immediate reaction to it and taking care of the issue. But we're not seeing that from the political spectrum, which Professor Whaley will be talking about at length. And I really think that that's what we need to pay attention to. And this is highlighted particularly right now, of course, as you know, next Monday there's a special election in Alabama for a U.S. Senate seat. And one of the contenders for that seat is a Republican candidate who's been accused of, for all intents and purposes, molesting a 14-year-old female adolescent and several others in a string over numerous years. The president of the United States has been accused by, I think it's either 8 to 10 women of sexual harassment and or sexual assault. This is just something that is, completely beyond the pale, but what even makes reporters like me who've been doing this job for a while kind of sit back and go, but wait, is that for the first time, this has shifted into an arena where it's like the voters aren't really seeming to be all fazed by that. The last polling we had, for example, out of Alabama, showed Judge Moore ahead of his Democratic opponent. And as you know, President Trump continues to, tweet and offend and this, that, and the other thing, and there doesn't seem to be any willingness on the part of the Republican leadership on the Hill to hold him accountable.
Right.
So that's a general overview for this.
Yeah, there's a couple points there, Brody, that I would just come back with you at. One is I wouldn't say it's all voters, but it is certainly the Alabama voter, which appears to be unfazed. And when we bring Professor Whaley on, we can maybe look at why there, why now, and look at whether that's done in other environments as well. But also the other thing I would want to point out is that this stuff has been happening in secret for a long, long time. And to put an optimistic spin on it, is that, the covers have come off on something that has been existing. I would theorize, at least in the private sector where the immediate action is taking place, that certainly people who might be tempted to go into this behavior in the future probably will not. I know from the corporate side where I come from that, where these things have been exposed in the past, it is now very rigid. There's a lot of required training and, people are very, very careful in their behaviors and that type of thing. So I'm kind of hopeful that this is actually a turning point in a lot of the arenas. But as you pointed out, it doesn't seem to be doing that in the political one, and that's concerning.
That's very concerning, and I think that's something also that will be good to get Professor Whaley's input on. In September of 1995, a congressional committee submitted what pretty much amounted to an indictment that pointed out that Senator Bob Pack was or an Oregon Republican, had more or less sexually harassed, dozens of women. And this, again, he was forced to resign instead of being expelled by the Senate. But there didn't seem to be a learning curve with that. And, of course, now we've got Minority Leader Pelosi and Speaker Ryan asking, Representative John Clares of Michigan to, bow out for essentially the same thing. We've had other incidences take place previously, including a Florida congressman who was bounced out of the House for suggestive social media tweets and messages and emails to congressional pages. And, of course, the House reaction to that was to do away with House pages. So it's a matter of accountability. It's a matter of, it's problematic, and it's like Washington doesn't seem to care. Now, I agree that you're saying that Alabama voters, but I'm also looking at the narrative coming from the fact that, I'm not hearing a lot of outcry coming from, the Republicans, in other states in the leadership positions within the RNC that are really putting the pressure on. And, now we have the president that's more or less endorsed Judge Moore.
Right. That's the characterization of the voters that I would say are in question, however, because it's the same block of voters, i.e. the Republican Party voters, who still think Donald Trump is doing a good job, in a plurality, above 50%. That's the only block of voters that are in his camp in the current time, and they are the majority of Alabama, which is why Sessions got pulled out of Alabama in the first place, because they knew it was, quote-unquote, a safe environment, that, they were a shoe-in for whoever they they picked there. So, so it's anyway, we know where the problem is. We just want to see if it's contained there or it's more widespread. And I would actually argue, in based on past precedent, that it is more widespread. Let's bring on our authority on it. Welcome to the show, Professor Whaley. How are you doing this evening?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Very, very, very thankful for you to be joining us, and we want to bring you out of the closet so that we're not talking behind your back anymore. So welcome aboard.
Thank you. Lots to talk about, and setup there for a lot of the important issues that this whole debacle is bringing up here, not just legal ones.
So what the heck is going on in Washington?
So, I mean, I think there's a number of reasons, and some of them you touched on. I mean, in Hollywood, everybody has a boss, as you know, and bad publicity hurts the bottom line, and nobody is sacred. So there's not a lot of discussion around whether these women are lying or not, the ones that are accusing people like Matt Lauer and Garrison Keillor and some very revered public figures in the media. They're just, you know, once this becomes public in a way that could hurt profits, then you're out. In the public sector, you know, the boss is the voters, and it's an arduous, difficult process to vote a different person into office. You have to wait for the next election to come up unless there's some unusual circumstance. And as was mentioned, with someone who's actually a sitting member of Congress in either the House or the Senate, the framers of the Constitution set up a pretty high hurdle to fire them, which is Article 1's provision allowing a member to be expelled for disorderly conduct, presumably, arguably, I think it's probably conduct while in office, some kind of abuse of office. And that takes 2/3 of the particular chamber. So you need a bipartisan effort to sort of throw someone out, really difficult to do. So that's option, you know, that's one option. And then the next option, as was mentioned earlier, is public pressure from other members. That, you know, they lose their caucus, they lose their support, and so they sort of slink away in shame. And I don't know if there's, you know, it's just so polarized that the voting public of other constituencies, other members of Congress aren't, you know, weighing in here to say, listen, we don't want some of these people to continue in office. But the irony of it is, you know, notwithstanding how, you know, as I said, the framers set it up so the voters really get to pick and it's hard to oust them. And the irony of it is that you'd think that we would want people with particularly high ethics in positions where they are making laws, right, that bind lots of people, or in the case of judges where Roy Moore has sat, where they're making decisions that affect individual people's lives. Or, I mean, Roy Moore was also in the executive branch where they're deciding, picking and choosing what laws to enforce against individual people. I mean, each branch of government is there to basically function as a fiduciary for the rest of us. And we've got to be really careful about who we put in office. And I just think voters, Alabama and across the country, in electing President Trump, have lost sight of really what our government does and why they're there for us.
Absolutely. Brody, you had a question?
Yeah, Professor Whaley, good evening. I was looking at the aspect of the fact that there is not a human resources set up, if you will, as such within the structure on Capitol Hill. Unlike, you know, the entertainment industry or my business or the media, you know, we have human resources and we have things in place. There's no HR there to filter out things. And I think that maybe along the way, some things, you know, get lost. Do you see that as kind of a negative impact, negative influence on some of these cases when it comes down to these politicians on the Hill?
Sure, absolutely. So you mentioned the Bob Packwood situation in 1995, and mm-hmm. It was at that point, in response to that, that Congress passed a statute called the Congressional Accountability Act of all things, where Congress basically said, listen, we have all kinds of laws protecting individual rights. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act that bans discrimination on the basis of certain categories. The Americans with Disabilities Act, the Rehabilitation Act, the Family Medical Leave Act. And we're going to apply all those things to us now. We're going to say we are bound by these laws that everybody else is bound by. But the kicker was that they set up their own process, internal sort of administrative process, for getting these claims to court. When I say that, basically there were all kinds of wickets set up by members of Congress. There's an entity called the Congressional Office of Compliance that has five directors, all of whom are appointed by members of Congress. And so if somebody is a victim of sexual harassment, there is literally 3 months of mandatory counseling, mediation, and cooling off period before they can even file an administrative complaint. When I mean that, even file a complaint in Congress, that's not getting into court. And it's been reported, you know, at some point the member, if it is a member, gets legal counsel. There's certainly pressure to settle, and that gets swept under the rug. That's all not confidential. And the statute itself doesn't even apply to congressional interns. And, you know, I would think young women, you know, eager to please, are probably prime targets for this kind of behavior. And prior to this statute, 1993, the Washington Post reported that a third of female congressional employees said they had been sexually harassed in some capacity while employed at Congress. So I, as I was mentioned earlier, I think this is a deep, widespread problem, both in and out of the public service sector. But whatever procedures are in place, they're certainly not working. The system is absolutely clearly broken, and it's not even being tested. It's just, I think the light is being shined on the fact that it's a fallacy, really, that this is actually functioning a way to stop the bad behavior, which is what laws are really for, right? You know, so you drive down the street, and if you know there's a speed camera there, everybody in the neighborhood slows down for that block because they don't want to get the ticket in the mail. And there just haven't been any tickets in the mail for members of Congress, and for that matter, even for Hollywood, until now that it's been, you know, basically they've been outed, and then the retribution is swift. But to the extent to which, you know, we know what's going on in a wink and a nod, that's just been the case for years, and nothing's happened.
I don't necessarily disagree with that. I think that that's probably right where you're at with it. Marianne Cooper, who is a Stanford sociologist, told Vice in an interview earlier today, and I'll quote her, "The structure is different. The CEO of a company can decide to terminate someone in a top talent role. There's no one like that in Congress." And then Emily Martin, who's the Vice President for Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center, also said, "The Hill is also weird because it is essentially a large entity that functions like a bunch of small businesses. You get the worst side of a close informal office where there's no one whose job it is to help you negotiate something like sexual harassment." Let me ask you this, and I say this as a member of the media. I think that maybe it's possible that we're partially at fault for this because we haven't gotten serious about reporting these things, even though we're obviously aware of it. And I realize that in my profession in particular, it's very top-heavy, male-oriented. I realize that, you know, attitudes are changing and things like that. But at the same time, you know, I see kind of a patronizing attitude sometimes, especially from reporters my age. I'm in my late 50s, as opposed to the younger reporters, in dealing with this. It's almost as if they don't victim blame, they don't. You know, they don't believe the victim. And this has been a huge problem with The Hill. Let me get your feedback on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's less of a legal commentary or question than it is more sort of a social one. And I personally just believe that the degradation and marginalization of women in our particular, in our culture, has been socially acceptable for, you know, as long as I've been alive, meaning, you know, there are lots of discrimination that goes on with lots of categories of people, but it seems that when it comes to women, it's kind of like what happened when President Trump's Access Hollywood tape hit. Some people thought, oh, he's over, and then he comes out and says, well, it's locker room talk. You know, that's just locker room talk. And I think that resonated with a lot of people, that somehow locker room talk is just what happens, and women roll with it. And I do think if men in power, if there's no accountability, they're not going to necessarily be incentivized to change that system. So I don't think it's entirely the media. I mean, it's happened back with, you know, Clarence Thomas, and there was quite a bit of uproar over that, the allegations. But, you know, Anita Hill was roundly criticized at the time, and that seemed to stick. I mean, this has been, I think, an intractable social norm that, for whatever reason, I don't know if it's because so many social norms are being tested and blown up from the top levels of government right now, that we're just looking at stuff with fresh eyes. But it's refreshing to see to take it seriously as really a human rights violation. You know, no one uses that terminology, but I think it's experienced that way by women and girls across the country.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's Rob. Very true. I think the human rights violation and the new awareness is a refreshing aspect to this. Professor Wiley, I wanted to ask you something, and this was sort of reflective of some comments you made tonight and from your article, and Brody kind of alluded to this in what he said at the very beginning. I'm starting to rethink, and I was totally in agreement with this point, but I'm starting to rethink it based on my own reactions to things in the past, and that is the concept that, you know, the voters are kind of the bosses here, and we're leaving it up to the voters to essentially, quote unquote, fire the bad guys. And which I get that concept. However, one of the big differences is, like, let's take Matt Lauer. NBC fires Matt Lauer. There's another Matt Lauer of some sort waiting in the wings. I mean, you know, the talent, you know, bubbling up, waiting for Matt Lauer's job is there. And so NBC is not really at risk. They're going to end up with some crack person stepping into the limelight, carrying on, you know, new fresh face, all of that sort of stuff. What we have in place of the voters, when we're the ones who are voting for it, or Alabama are the ones that are voting for it, we're asking them to kill off probably the person philosophically who is most likely to carry forward their own agenda. And the reason I'm relating to that is because when it was Bill Clinton, I have to say, I wasn't really eager to scrutinize his behavior and look into, you know, who was, telling the truth about him and all that, because I didn't want the guy out of office. I didn't want, you know, the other party to take power. You know, I wanted the Democrats to stay in power, so I was hoping for that to just kind of go away. And I'm getting the sense from the Alabama voters, they're the same. You know, it's like, and that's what's winning the argument is, you know, vote for your selfish interests, not the greater good, and not, you know, the integrity of this guy. You know, because you'd rather have a sick criminal in there who's fighting for your interests than a great guy who's fighting against your interests. Bottom line, is there truth to that? And if that is the case, how do we get around it?
Well, I mean, there's a couple things there. I mean, one is I agree that there's a tremendous power struggle between the two major political parties, and it's just become super, super polarized, right? And when President Trump won, my students were kind of, some of them were just awestruck and visibly upset the next morning. And I stopped the class and I figured I had to say something, and I made a speech about the difference between policy and politics. You know, politics is ideological, and kind of the ends, that is, we win, winning justifies whatever means are. Policy is like what really works for me and my family and my community in the future. And so I would say, you know, voters are misled or don't really fully understand or aren't appreciating the extent to which their best interest really is putting people in power that have some measure of integrity. So that's the first thing. The second thing is with Bill Clinton, you know, I was in the Whitewater investigation, and doesn't necessarily belie my politics one way or the other. And that, you know, that's come up a lot. Well, the Clintons, and my response to that is twofold. First of all is, you know, at least today, the Clintons are no longer in power. Obama's no longer in power. And so they're regular citizens, and it's kind of, in my mind, at least today, in making the comparison, it's completely beside the point because they don't exercise any power on my behalf anymore. So I don't really have to worry about how they do it. The second part is, you know, for better or worse, Bill Clinton was held accountable, right? I mean, he was impeached. He lost his law license. You know, we might have disagree as to whether it was enough, but it wasn't like he sort of got a completely free pass. You know, there's a statute that he was prosecuted under by an independent entity, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we might have been rooting for our political candidate, but in that instance, there was a process of accountability. And I think was mentioned earlier by one of you that seems to be missing in this instance. It seems to be that we leave our integrity at the door just so our team wins. And my message is, you know, wait a minute, you got to really think about what that means. I mean, I think people have this mythical sort of misunderstanding about our constitutional structure, this idea that, oh, I can put some awful, corrupt person in office because I have my constitutional rights. And the constitutional rights are not this, you know, a bouncer outside your door making sure that everything's taken care of for you. It's the Constitution's a piece of paper, just like a contract, right? If you don't have the money or the energy to sue your kitchen renovator who walks off on the job, he walks off on the job. I mean, you got to go to court and enforce that. And that's kind of my point here is this really matters in the long term to the extent to which that piece of paper continues to mean what we all just assume it means. So that's a really long answer to your question. But I believe it, you know, quite passionately, both as a citizen and as a professor. The other thing I want to just raise on something that was said earlier about the media's role in this that kind of occurred to me, and that is, and this gets to your question, I think, a little bit about Bill Clinton, too. There's like a blending of wrongdoing where we are right now, this idea that, okay, sexual misconduct is of a kind and everybody who does it should be tarred and feathered. And criminal laws make distinctions between first-degree sexual assault, which is groping, and fourth-degree, which is, you know, rape. And
right, right.
I think part of what's happening with Roy Moore is now that, you know, we're hearing about the celebrities going down, no one's talking about Roy Moore anymore, right? But as you mentioned, the election's next week, and he's probably quite happy to be out of, you know, the limelight and the firing squad, you know, whatever the analogy is, because it's like, oh, everybody does it. What's the big deal with Roy Moore? Well, the difference is the degree, the severity of it, the how it's so, I think, credible and from a legal standpoint, factual standpoint, it's probably provable if it were still available as far as a cause of action. And what we're talking about putting him in office, it seems to me they can drum up another Republican that can vote sort of for small government and anti-immigration, whatever that platform is, that isn't, as was mentioned here, you know, likely guilty of severely, I mean, the most abhorrent type behavior that a society would tolerate. Sorry, I said a lot of things, but I think it was
interesting. No,
brilliant. Question.
You had us in rapt attention. Brody, you had a question?
Yeah, I keep going, Professor. I'm auditing your course.
Thank you.
You're welcome. As a former United States assistant United States attorney, and you've obviously dealt with the federal courthouses in the district as well as Baltimore. Let's talk for a moment about criminal liabilities here. And let's talk a little bit about results and the Constitution. You're a constitutional scholar as well as a professor of law in Constitution. And let's talk about unlikely things like Judge Moore becoming elected as senator and some of the things that are going on with Representative Conyers and some of the others on the Hill. Well, let's talk about it from a legal point of view, because you started to go there and you immediately caught my interest, because it's like, where exactly are the legal lines drawn? And there's something I should note here. There is a public perception that Congress is untouchable. It's an entity unto itself. That argument has taken itself over to the other end of the avenue, for example, and I'm not going to say we need to get into this conversation, but if you'll remember, Trump exercised his presidential pardon powers on Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona, and there has often been questioning about exactly how absolute is the federal presidential pardon, and in this particular instance, you know, it's that question raises itself because of the peculiarities of both how either end of the avenue operates. Let's talk about the Hill for a second, because that seems to be the real cesspool there. As a former assistant U.S. attorney, and you have to go to a grand jury, what are you looking for with these things?
Well, I mean, so there's – so to sort of the broader response to your question is it's – the public has this perception that, members of Congress are above any kind of accountability. Certainly in the Constitution itself, there are – as was mentioned, you know, there's a way of firing them. It's cumbersome. Otherwise, you wait for the next election. That's less than tolerable, really, for some people. But that's the way – I mean, the framers did not want sort of a bully government to just be able – some, you know, a dictator to come in and fire everybody. They specifically set it up in a way – when you talk about what's the separation of powers, the checks and balances, those terms get thrown around. Those things aren't written anywhere in the Constitution. But the idea is – there's always someone to grade the other one's papers, right? So, and we can go through this, but the judges and the president have ways of kind of knocking down Congress. Congress and the president have ways of knocking down judges, et cetera. We can talk about that. So constitutionally, it's very difficult. Certainly, if there's a violation of a criminal law, a sitting member of Congress, if there's a prosecutor with the appetite to look into it, they're going to look at a criminal law that Congress passed that in theory represents the public's view that this is intolerable behavior. So you take statutory rape. I mean, the legislature puts that into place on the theory that the public wants that illegal, right? And so a grand jury will look at, well, okay, are there, what are the facts to that bear on that question, and are there enough that we can get a conviction? It's not sort of a, did they do it or not, or are they a bad person, or it's, can we prove it? It's very concrete. I mean, we also see lots of talk about these fake facts and fake news, and, you know, lawyers know there are such a thing as facts and there are not facts, right? And then the third part is civil laws, like we talked about earlier, that you mean to cut you off. But, you know, the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which I said, you can bring these lawsuits against members of Congress in a court and get money. But the internal procedures that Congress set up for itself are so difficult, and you know, there are so many hurdles, it's just not realistic. And, you know, it's just made it such that it's not really a viable – it's not something, I put another way, that I think they spend a lot of time worrying about. And, well, of course, we heard there's a fund to pay them.
Right. Let me – a quick follow-up, because I know Rob wants to bring my colleague on who's joined us. Let me ask you this, Professor. Looking at the term congressional immunity, because that gets tossed around a lot by some of my sources on Capitol Hill. I heard it again today as they were discussing Representative Conyers and things like that. And I'll make this quick. Do you see that as a real scenario and a real situation, this idea of congressional immunity? I mean in a broader sense, not necessarily in a legalistic way, but in a way that they look at it.
Well, I don't know. I'd have to sort of follow up with what your sources were. I mean, and as far as immunity, you know, members of Congress do have immunity in doing their job as Congress. Just like the president has immunity doing the presidential stuff. Judges have immunity doing judge stuff. So if a judge issues a decision, you can't sue that person, sue the judge, because they made that decision. Congress cannot be sued for a member of Congress can't be sued. They have immunity from being sued for casting a vote in one way or the other. But that, they certainly aren't like above the law. And we can talk about the president. I mean, I've actually written and done some media commentary on the pardon power. I'm happy to talk about that and impeachment and all those things. And there's some legal disagreement over the extent to which the president as a sitting president can be held accountable under the criminal and civil laws. But I to the extent to which what you're asking is that real or not that, oh, Congress can just walk around with immunity from being accountable under civil and criminal laws? No, there is no such blanket immunity for, you know, killing somebody, for example, or, you know, maybe
right.
they're in a, once they tell the cops that they're the ones who ran the red light, maybe they give them a pass, but I don't think I think that's just more of a matter of, you know, respect and authority, not so much because the law exempts them, although in theory they can exempt themselves from laws, federal laws.
Sounds good.
I could have sworn I saw that scenario on a Law and Order, but then they take a lot of poetic license. So I'm kidding.
Well,
kidding.
And it's not so poetic anymore. And in 2017, you know, there's some of the stuff that shows us mythology in TV is now real. I feel like happening in the Washington, D.C.
Totally true. So I do want to introduce Don Enos to the conversation. Don is our one of our distinguished journalist panelists. Don, welcome to the show tonight.
Hey, everybody. I'm sorry I'm late. Technical difficulties.
And we know those very, very well. So, Don, what were your initial thoughts, and did you have some initial questions for Professor Whaley?
Indeed. I've been listening since 10:30, and I'm very pleased to e-meet you or audio-meet you. I think that the last point is the most relevant. The whole world is upside down right now. I mean, there's a man in the White House who used to be a TV star who is a sexual predator who is not going to face any kind of charges. And yet TV people are getting fired left and right. It's amazing to me the disparity between our elected leaders and our entertainment president. It also reminds me of when Back to the Future had Ronald Reagan as president, and Doc Brown couldn't believe that Ronald Reagan might be president in 1985. I worked with Matt Lauer at WWOR-TV, a little TV station in Secaucus, New Jersey. I worked with him at the Today Show. It was an open secret that he would do whatever he wanted to do. I was presenting his mail back then, so I was obviously not one of his targets. But it wasn't a surprise that top executives and top talent had buttons under their desks that could close doors behind you and to push a button that would lock the door behind you. It wasn't a surprise that nobody dared speak of what he did. And when people did speak up, suddenly they were transferred or reassigned or no longer there. Now, what surprises me is the backlash against the victims. I had a discussion today with a very outspoken, sex positive gay man who I respect very much, a great writer, who was concerned, Professor, about how this whole eruption of Me Too stories and people getting raked over the coals publicly and losing their jobs will affect the gay male community in terms of how there may be fallout, that sex positivity may suffer because people will misinterpret flirting or misinterpret what I think most gay men do in terms of being very out about their sexual feelings. My response to him was, no matter what orientation you have, the workplace is no place for sex, especially among women, straight, lesbian, bi, panty, whatever, doesn't matter. The workplace is not a place for sex. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are in terms of how does this affect the LGBT community specifically? Is there a chilling effect that you think this could have?
Well, I haven't thought about it in the terms specifically of the LGBT community, but I have heard that comment made from white males, frankly, heterosexual males, for this idea that, and actually even females, saying, wait a minute, we can't go so far that, you know, if you hold a door open for someone, then somehow you've harassed them. And, I think we're so far in the dark in the other direction. We're so, and I said, not only the dark in terms of not having this be on the table, but in the dark in terms of the dark ages and what's acceptable, that that we'll have a cultural shift, right? We'll get to the point where things, I hope, will calibrate such that we're reasonable as a culture and we understand when something constitutes potentially unlawful behavior, and then it's maybe a little off color. I mean, the example I use in the law is negligence. So someone can be, you know, leave a stair on with a huge gap in it for, you know, weeks and weeks, and many people fall on it. That we all think that's negligent. I mean, come on, fix your step. You know, people are walking up and down it all the time, but we're not so much worried if, okay, it was snowing and they didn't fully shovel their walk. We understand as a society where reasonable lines are and are not drawn. And I think certainly the GLBT community is in a position where they unfortunately have more work to do in normalizing some of these things that people have not particularly impressive views around, right? But when it comes to women and women's, you know, their bodies and their personal space and, you know, not making comments about, you know, their personal parts, which seems to be fair game in our modern culture. I think that if we could put a stop to that, then we can recalibrate and see where the lines are drawn between what is illegal behavior, what's socially completely unacceptable behavior, and what's just joking around and, you know, affection. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that's
it does.
That's
it does.
Where I come on it.
Very good. I have to say, you know, I come from the corporate world, the business corporate world, and there, just, you know, Don, to maybe allay some fears, there's the trainings there are pretty thorough on where those lines are that the professor was talking about. And a lot of the, ironically, some of the potential issues about quote-unquote hostile work environment would more be from somebody who is completely anti-gay and thinking that if you just say you're gay, that you have now violated their what they want in terms of their pristine world. And I think that's why a lot of corporations are fighting for equality across the board, because then they don't have to, you know, then they have those standards upheld that people are allowed to be out and gay, just not overtly sexually intrusive. I wanted to shift it slightly, though, because, Don, you brought up something that I thought was very interesting in your initial comments. And there's an articles are coming out now around the Matt Lauer thing that are alluding to this, that there is a difference of cases being brought to corporations, i.e. somebody making an actual complaint saying this happened on this day and, you know, I was violated, et cetera, versus environments where what, Don, you just said, quote unquote, open secrets, where the corporation actually is aware that they have somebody in their midst that is creating that environment.
Well,
and
Bill
it's well
O'Reilly,
known, even though,
yeah,
Bill O'Reilly or Donald Trump. I mean, it's like,
sure.
Donald Trump, you know, with his comments on Access Hollywood, identified himself as that type of person, even if, although Brody rightly pointed out, there are actual accusers that, you know, they created that environment. Professor Whaley, how is that balance of both on a corporate level and in the government where some powers or be are aware that somebody is creating an environment without accusers? You know, is that ever going to be accountable, or is there a way to make those entities accountable for policing that?
Well, you know, one of the things I did in my career was work at the Department of Justice in the civil division of the U.S. Attorney's Office, as was mentioned. So when various federal agencies were sued for all kinds of violations of the law, including sex harassment and sex discrimination, those complaints would come through our office and we would defend the government. And my sense, this was years ago, but my sense was you know, the legitimate ones, when I say the ones that were really problematic, they would get settled fairly early. And it was an environment where I think people were sensitive to the implications of making adverse personnel decisions based on race or gender, or, you know, one of the other protected categories, or creating an environment where, you know, sex was inappropriately used as a, you know, a topic of conversation or a means of managing people. And so I'd have to think a little further about why that's so. I mean, I think the procedures for filing a complaint were straightforward and people used them. And I don't think that it was something that was, you know, people were retaliated against. And of course, there's also a federal statute that bans retaliation. So many of these complaints would say, you discriminated against me. And then when I filed a complaint, you know, you moved me to the back office. So then that's a double whammy. And to the extent to which, you know, laws are actually enforced, right? If there's a speed trap in the three blocks on Connecticut Avenue, so everybody slows down, people slow down. And I think to the extent to which we have laws in place that aren't being enforced, then we need to take a look at that, that we need to pay attention to that. I mean, and it, you know, someone mentioned this notion that, you know, I think when Don got on, mentioned like the biggest issue right now is the fact that there's so much going on in Washington. And I feel like it's one thing after another, and we're drinking from a fire hose, and so much of it is going by the wayside. And meaning things like the emoluments clause and conflicts of interest, things like not disclosing tax returns, and things like, you know, abhorrent behavior on a diplomatic level that we don't even want our children to, you know, tweets we don't even want our children to hear because they're inappropriate. That kind of stuff we just start getting used to, and then it becomes part of what's an appropriate lexicon, or at least acceptable lexicon, from our elected officers. And that's a problem. We have to hold down the fort, right? We have to reinforce the foundation of our constitutional structure if it's going to survive in a way that protects everyone, not just Democrats or Republicans, but everyone. And that, I just think that message has gotten lost. There's so much information and hyperbole and ad hominem attacks, and that I think going back to basics and general civics classes and what law means and why we have laws and how they work and how they function and who enforces them. And I mean, I'm amazed every year that when my students come in and I give these really straight up blow by blow explanations of how our system works, and virtually all of them walk out aghast, like, wow, I never thought of it that way. And I just wish more people would tune into shows like this.
We've had a few questions for you. Brody, I think you wanted to ask yours because you were on topic to what you wanted to ask about.
Yeah, Professor, real quickly, I wanted to follow up with what you just said. And again, I want to go back to the legal aspects of it for just a second. Mm-hmm. As a United States attorney, or as an assistant U.S. attorney, did you ever see with your work at the Justice Department and the Civil Division a kind of a bias or a, well, we don't need to really prosecute this one, or maybe there's a way to defer this, or there's another way of handling it, if the sexual harassment or those types of scenarios were to come across your desk?
No. I mean, a lot of them were resolved, like I said, by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is kind of the intermediary administrative body that addresses these issues within the particular agency before they actually go to court. So then if they couldn't resolve them within the agency, then we would get them. And no, I mean, what's one of the sort of things I really appreciated about working for the federal government, which was my colleagues and I, we really wanted to do the right thing. And there were even times where a client that is, you know, a lawyer or a senior person at the agency would say, we want to make you to make X argument. And one of the sort of luxuries of being an assistant United States attorney is we can look the long term and say, you know what? If we win that argument in this case, it's going to affect all these other cases in ways that we as public servants aren't comfortable with. So I have to be honest, I didn't really see that in that capacity. I'm not saying everybody was squeaky clean, but it really
right.
was. People weren't on the wrong track when it came to this kind of stuff. And then we would take these cases up and take them to mediation, and a lot of them would settle, and some of them would go before a jury, and a jury would award settlement. And, you know, few people realize there is a fund for paying these claims in federal agencies as well. It's not just Congress that has a fund that pays out discrimination claims when they're settled or they get to a judgment. Taxpayer dollars pay them out of what's called a judgment fund. The difference is that for agencies, the law passed by Congress requires that the agencies themselves repay the judgment fund out of their own budgets. So again, back to my sort of speed trap scenario, if
right.
people within an agency understand that, listen, if we're going to let people discriminate willy-nilly, we're going to be paying millions of dollars out of our budget that now then we're stuck. We're going to have to start furloughing people. We're going to have to start shutting down programs. I mean, they're aware of it. They don't want to let it go on, not just because it's wrong morally and ethically, but because it hurts them. There's a consequence.
Right.
And
okay.
without a consequence, you know, bad behavior like the Matt Lauer stuff happens, right?
Sure, right. Yes.
I can relate to that as a parent. So, yeah, I hear
yes,
you on that.
Yes, you
Dawn,
can.
You had, yeah, right, exactly. Dawn, you had a question?
Any parent.
Well, yeah, I wanted to see if Kimberly can explain something to me. Unless I've missed it, not one woman in the public sphere has been accused of sexual harassment in this recent explosion. Why is that?
Gosh, you know, I'm trying to, we know my initial thought went to my own experience in the office and whether I had a case like that, and I can't remember a case like that. That doesn't mean they don't exist.
You think it's a different standard, or is it that men are afraid of saying a woman harassed me, or is it just that, as I think, women just work differently?
Yeah, I there was on another show I was listening to earlier, there was a different station that I appeared on, so I was like listening to the lead up, the people that were on before me. There was a member of a state New Jersey legislative caucus woman who was on, and she gave a vignette about just sort of as legislators how women and men are different, and she was basically saying, you know, sex discrimination in her long experience was rampant for many years, and oftentimes women just don't get listened to, and if they are harassed, even as elected officials, there can be retaliation in terms of not supporting their legislative initiatives, all that kind of stuff. But essentially, I wish I could remember her name, but I can't right now. But she said there was one instance where it was a highly fraught, very polarized vote, Republicans versus Democrats, and it got to this point where the men were really angry with each other and just in this power struggle that was going nowhere in the chamber. And the women sort of quietly all got together and steeled off to a conference room and sat down and hashed it out, you know, and resolved the issue amongst themselves, Republicans and Democrats. And I, you know, I'm not a sociologist or psychologist. I mean, I'm also a parent, and you know, an observer of human nature. And I don't think women have the same, I don't know if it's a desire to be in power, to exert power, to win. I really don't know. My guess would be the statistics would bear out that gender gap as well in terms of the number of claims, both in the civil side and then also sexual assault, criminal side. But I don't
know. I would point out, though, because I know of anecdotally a couple of lesbians who have had accusations against them made. So I think mm-hmm. there is potentially something in terms of who's on the receiving end. Plus,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, in a lot of places, I mean, this requires a person who is in power to mm-hmm. be, you know, putting upon somebody who is in less power and has reason to be either afraid of them or intimidated. And unfortunately, women have not been put in that area of power in wide enough that, you know, if we're going to statistically test it, which is
true.
It's a bad reason to put women in power, but it is back to that disease that there's that glass ceiling that women have been held behind, you know, to test it out fully. I guess is my point.
Sure, and I think women psychologically or just personality-wise are, you know, we build bridges, we're communicators. I mean, we're, you know, even if they were put in power, my guess is, I don't know if it would be better or worse, but I think the power dynamic from the top down would be different. It would feel different.
But we just
haven't gotten there. We're not even, we don't know. You're right. It's a thought experiment because we don't know.
Well, we're kind of nearing the end of the show. We only have about 4 minutes left. I did want to go back to Alabama and ask you about a potential strategy. Because the Republicans in Congress have basically said that should Roy Moore get elected, they will throw him in front of their ethics process, et cetera. Is that potentially a good or smart strategy on their part? Let him get elected, then put him feet to the fire, and then potentially, you know, have him ousted and replaced with another Republican, rather than risk him losing to a Democrat up front?
Oh, you're saying from the Republican standpoint.
Right.
Is that a good strategy? You know, it's hard to imagine. I mean, it's a fraud strategy in part because if that happens, then there's going to be so much attention on Roy Moore and the circus around the ethics investigations and the anger that he's sitting in, that it could actually be counterproductive on their end. On the other hand, you know, the numbers in the Senate are so fine in terms of the Senate majority, and we'll see what happens the rest of the week, but we don't yet have a tax bill signed by the president, and that's their signature agenda. It's like that's the end that justifies whatever means we get to. I would hope that this does continue, frankly, though, if he's put in office. I mean, what would make me, I think, a little downtrodden would be to see what happened with the president. That is, these allegations are serious going into office, and then just we go on with business as usual. The fire hose keeps, you know, spraying water in our face,
yeah,
and there's another crisis. And next thing we know, Roy Moore's just, you know, standing on the floor, to, you know, arguing for his bill. And it's a footnote somewhere. I mean, that would be, I don't know. That would mean, I wonder sometimes if that's kind of the strategy to just, there's just
wait
so
it out.
Much going on. Yeah. And just wait for the next insane sort of shocking thing to happen that is unprecedented constitutionally and as a matter of foreign policy and legally. And then we're all focused on that.
I hope that doesn't happen. And well, we have to leave our note on that. We just hope, you know, the fire hose, you know, doesn't continue and that, you know, it doesn't go back. This doesn't become status quo after the election. I want to thank you, Professor Whaley, for joining us tonight. It has been absolutely fascinating, and you've been wonderful, and you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you. On
any other subject, your input has been fantastic. Brody and Dawn, as always, you guys are stellar and great questions, great discussion. Thank you both for holding your regular chairs here. Great
absolutely.
Job on everyone.
So well, I enjoyed it. Thank you for inviting me.
It's been really, really great. Really great. And I want to thank our listeners for listening in. Next week, we will have another fantastic thought-provoking show on Rated LGBT Radio. Also, listen on Saturday night, 7 p.m., on www.ksco.com to Out in Santa Cruz. We'll be talking about a lot of other issues with the LGBT community, and that is also a call-in show, and you are welcome to be there. Again, thank you all for joining. Good night, and we will talk to you next week.